At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho.
So I was watching Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark the other day, and to an extent, the Holy Grail, but more specifically, Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I was just kind of really thinking about Nazi Germany and just the whole situation there. And obviously, Indiana Jones is amazing, and I'm also a huge fan of Inglourious Basterds. And I wanted to know more about the topic of Nazi Germany and really kind of delve into it. And I just happened to meet somebody who has studied this and has been to Auschwitz and made a short film there. And it's Hannah Taylor, who I met in England. And she's a wrestler. She's a Twitch performer. She's a horror movie expert and very, very knowledgeable about this topic of Nazi Germany. So how did you originally start getting into this? Because it's such a deep, dark subject.
So when I was growing up, my dad was like hugely into history. And he used to take me to all these museums when I was younger. And then I started watching movies, like more movies as a teenager. Do you know when you kind of become a teenager and you get more and more into what cool films are?
Right.
And I ended up studying film at university, studying my master's degree as well at university.
Which university?
Liverpool.
Liverpool, right.
Yeah. So I did a couple of kind of essays on how Nazis are portrayed in cinema and how it's influenced cinema. And then in my third year for my bachelor's degree, we were tasked to, you know, make a documentary. And the documentary could be pretty much anything we wanted to do. And I'm like a huge fan of Ziga Vertov, who did a movie called Man with the Movie Camera. I think it was the early 1920s, and it's an observatory documentary. So it's kind of where you go to a place or a city and you just have a camera. It's like the Man with the Movie Camera. It's the name of the film. And he just filmed all these cool things. And I was like, that's the kind of documentary I want to do. And it sounds kind of pretentious, and maybe a little bit.
But you are a film student.
Yeah, of course I'm a film student. I have to be pretentious. But I was thinking, okay, what type of documentary do I want to do? And, you know, I've always had this interest in World War II history. And I've always wanted to visit Auschwitz-Birkenau. But then as I started researching more into it, I was like, Auschwitz is a place, but it's actually in a town. And it's in a town called Oswiecim. And I hope I pronounced that right, because there was a few different pronunciations. Like, there's an English way of pronouncing it. And then when we were there, the people who we spoke to pronounced it a little bit differently. But anyway, I was researching about the town, and I came across this photographer who went to Auschwitz, and they just did still photography, and they called it the shadow of Auschwitz. And it was, you have the camp, and it's what's outside of the camp.
And
it was, and I was like, people don't realize it was in an actual town.
Yeah, I always thought Auschwitz was the name of the town.
So I think during, I hope I remember this correctly, because I do have memory problems, but I think during the Second World War, they actually renamed the town to Auschwitz, and it was after the war that it went back to its original name. So there was like a group of us at university, and we kind of self-funded, pay for our own flights, pay for our hotels, and we stayed in Krakow. And we went over there, and obviously to do this type of documentary, and even when I was writing about films at university, you can't just write about film. You have to have the context of what was going on at the time. You can't go and analyze a film such as like Dead Snow, Inglourious Basterds, Indiana Jones without having the context of what happened during the Second World War.
What was going on then, right?
So we went over there and we stayed in Krakow. You have like places like the Schindler's Factory, the Jewish Quarter, but you have to take a bus that's around 2 hours to get there.
Right.
And so when we first went, our phones didn't work. So this is a few years ago. I was only 20 years old when I was doing this.
So where is this in accordance to, like, what bigger city in Germany is it?
Oh, it's Poland.
Oh, it's Poland. That's
Poland,
Russia's.
Poland, yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So,
I didn't know that. Okay.
So Krakow, we stayed there, but then you have to travel 2 hours to get to Oświęcim. There's trains, there's buses.
Right, of course.
So
what did you see when you got there?
Well, when we got there, we got dropped off this bus. Our phones weren't working properly, so we got dropped off on the bus, and we had no idea where to go. So it was a weird start, because we had all our film equipment with us. We were, like, very young. So we started walking. We were walking in the opposite direction, so Auschwitz was the opposite direction. So we ended up walking to a row of houses and a little kind of, I guess it would be like a suburban kind of street.
Yeah.
We had no idea where we were going. So we went into this, there was a bakery there. And at first I thought, wow, there is Auschwitz, like, is 5 minutes away and there's a bakery right here. Yeah. That to me was this place where all these hundreds of thousands of people died, and then you have a bakery.
Yeah, just right there. The two sides of humanity, right?
Yeah. So we went into the bakery and we were like, do you know how we can get to Auschwitz? And we tried to buy some of the baked goods to say thank you. And they weren't even taking our money. They were such nice people.
Uh-huh.
And then I think the woman who owned the bakery grabbed her husband, and her husband drove us to Auschwitz. So when we got there, one of the things I'd always heard before I went to Auschwitz from people I'd spoken to who had been, or from what I'd read online, there was no wildlife there. There's nothing there. But when we went, there was crows, there were squirrels around. So for me, that's kind of more ominous, that you have this awful place and people say, oh, there's no wildlife here. But there is.
Did you go inside?
Yeah, obviously? So there's Auschwitz, and then there's Birkenau. And then there's technically one called Auschwitz 3, but that's further away, and it's basically just rubble now.
Right.
So Auschwitz, it's more of like a museum. So when we went in there, you go on like tours, and there was the room full of hair. So, and then the room full of like spectacles, glasses that they take.
What's the room full of hair?
So you go in and it's kind of, there's no photography there from what I remember. Like, you can't film anything, you can't take photos, which is completely understandable. So you go in, and what I remember, it was like a huge, huge glass case. I don't want to say how many feet, but it was very big, and it's just filled with human hair that they put into a pile, and it's filled with human hair.
Why the hair from the...
From the prisoners. So what they would do was they would shave the hair of the prisoners and they would use it for textiles.
Oh my gosh.
So from what I remember reading is they would take the hair and make things like socks out of it and give it to their soldiers. And I can't remember the name of the... There was recently a car company that they had found human hair that had been used in their cars in the early 40s.
Oh, I see.
And they found elements of Zyklon B inside the hair, which shows that the prisoners were probably gassed and they'd taken the hair.
Oh, my goodness.
And
then you said there was also a same thing filled with spectacles, of glasses?
Yeah, so glasses. They would just take the glasses from the prisoners, and they would also take the fillings from their teeth, gold fillings,
right,
and use that as well.
Use that to make gold-plated... God silverware, knows what
they
whatever
did
the hell
of it. They would steal whatever they could, and that's what they do to the prisoners. So we went. There was that room. There was the room with the glasses, and then you kind of go outside and you see these they're kind of like cabins, like these where they would keep. It was more of a labor camp, I think.
Yeah,
this one.
Yeah.
And then you walk past, and there was the firing wall, and that was the execution wall where they would shoot prisoners. And they had a very small gas chamber that you went through. And this was just in Auschwitz. And
right.
Then as you come out of there, so that is more like a museum. So things are set up there for you to see and learn about. And you know, when you go to a museum, you see them in glass cases. So outside of there, this is the more interesting one for me, is you get a short bus and go to Auschwitz-Birkenau. And Auschwitz-Birkenau is very untouched. It's, you go in and everyone knows the kind of, the train track that runs down the middle, the sign. So that's Auschwitz-Birkenau. And that is where you had the women's bunkers, the men's bunkers. You had the incinerators as well, and the gas chambers. And we were filming there. And it's so strange because it's beautiful. There's trees there. It's landscape. It's,
yeah.
And there was Himmler was the one who was very into organizing the concentration camps and the death camps. He would visit them regularly, make sure they were ran in a way that he saw fit. And he had this idea that these camps have to be near wildlife and lakes because it was pure. And he felt that if these prisoners are in a place that's pure and natural, they will, that will filter into their kind of ideology. So we were filming the bunkers, and I went towards the women's bunkers, and I can't explain how it made me feel, because when you're seeing the stuff behind the cases in the museum, that's one thing, but to be inside these bunkers, and they were so small, and there was hundreds of women in them, and hundreds of children as well. Hmm. And you realize what they went through. And then it was very cold. We went to film in February, and it was freezing. And the prisoners obviously had to work in those conditions as well for hours on, I think it was less than 500 calories a day.
Let me ask you a couple questions, first of all, just to kind of put some context into what you're talking about, context. So, first of all, how many millions of Jews died in these camps?
They say at least 6 million altogether.
6 million?
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And why was Hitler so intent on wiping out the Jewish race?
So it wasn't just the Jewish race.
I don't know if the Jewish race is even the dwarf, the Jewish people, I guess you might say.
So it wasn't just,
the Jews.
No, he did target the Jews. But then he targeted homosexuals. He targeted political opposition. He targeted prostitutes, communists. So anyone that didn't fit in with their kind of ideology, that's who they targeted as well. But it was towards the end of the war. So at first they were killing for ideological reasons, but then towards the end of the war, so Auschwitz was liberated in 1944, but then there was still more death camps and gassings going on after Auschwitz. So they were losing the war at this point. So Ravensbrück is the all-women's camp, and what they did is they dismantled some of the gas chamber from Auschwitz because they could be transported, and they brought it to Ravensbrück. And at this point, these camps were so overpopulated because they evacuated all of the Jews and apoliticals from the east and brought them over, and they set up gas chambers in these camps because it wasn't just for ideological reasons. It was because for them at the time, it was productive. They couldn't have this many people in the camp. So they were killing essentially for the sake of killing.
And the Jews were the biggest target for Hitler because they went against his ideologies?
I honestly can't say the reason. It was social Darwinism.
Gotcha.
So the idea of like this mass race, this pure Aryan race, the blonde hair, blue eyes that everyone knows about, and it wasn't, they weren't ethnically pure.
Gotcha.
Essentially. So if they didn't fit in with that, they were sent away.
Wow. Okay. So these camps are there, and now so what, the Nazis would just raid people out of their homes, wherever they were. You mentioned Poland, for example, herd them into trains and take them there? Or kind of tell us a little bit how they herded them together, I guess you'd say.
So there was loads of different things that they did. Yeah. So they had the SS Einsatzgruppen, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I read a huge book on that. And they were these death squads that went through Europe and they killed civilians. They just went around killing civilians. Not everyone was gassed. In the early 1940s, I think it was, they also killed children with disabilities. So obviously the disabled were also targeted because it was this idea of like pureness, and they felt that they were an economic burden and they were not, you know, people they wanted in the bloodline. So gotcha. One of the things I remember reading about was they set up these children's hospitals, used children hospitals in quotation marks. They were essentially murder sentences for children who had disabilities or health issues.
It's terrible, yeah.
Yeah, and so obviously when you say, like, you know, they targeted Jews, they targeted children as well, they targeted women, they targeted men, homosexuals, they didn't just target Jews. And there was, I think, 30 of these centres. I know two were in Poland, I think two or three were in Poland, two in Austria. And essentially they would bring children who were medically disabled or had something wrong with them, and they would take them to these, they were essentially disguised as pediatric centers, and they would tell the parents, hey, we're going to treat your children, and then they would speak to the parents and get consent to have them treated. And
this probably early on in the war, I imagine. Right?
I think it was 40, 41.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I gotcha. Yeah. Because the war was 39 to 44, basically, right? World War II. So what you're saying is it's probably, my point is before everyone knew what the Nazis were all about.
Yeah. There's 30 killing wards or special children wards. And I think it was over 5,000 they killed in total.
Oh, wow.
And the thing is, you hear 6 million Jews, or I think the SS Einsatzgruppen killed over, I think, 200 to 300,000 all through Europe. So 5,000 seems like such a small number. But this is what is so sad. Like 5,000 children had died, at least. You always have to say there was probably so many more. So what they would do is they would use incentives to get consent from the parents to give their children treatment. And I use treatment in quotation marks. It was essentially authorized murder. And these parents didn't know that this was going to happen to their children.
Of course.
Some children died of overdoses of barbiturates, narcotics, others of starvation, neglect, the conditions that they were actually kept in. They were kept in cold temperatures, and they were withheld medical treatment as well.
That's terrible. So mm-hmm. It's not just like you said, mass murdering. There's a lot of torturing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure we'll talk about some of the experiments that you always hear about and that sort of thing. But so, like, when you're talking about, like,
the experiments.
Well, I want to get there, but so what you're saying, but most of the men, there was some that were working there,
mm-hmm.
but mostly they were killed, right?
A lot of them were killed. So a lot of the men were used as labor for the war effort. So they were used to make munitions. They were used to make stuff that they would use in the actual war as well.
Okay.
So it was free labor, essentially.
Gotcha.
So, for example, Ravensbrück, the camp I mentioned before.
The women's camp.
Yeah. So there's a book called by Sarah Helm that delves into Ravensbrück. And they would use the women in the camps as labor for different companies. And on the edge of the camp, Siemens, the company, would use the women for their production. So they would take women as free labor from the camps and use them.
And Siemens is still around now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I do believe that they've
made compensation.
No, they haven't. They have said no knowledge of this. They've never been accountable for.
Gotcha. No accountability. Gotcha.
And obviously, it's whether they knew what was happening to the women in these camps. So, and if these women couldn't work anymore, some of them were obviously killed. And if they, if a woman can't work anymore and you're sending her back to the camp, do you know what's going to happen to her?
Right.
Where is the responsibility there for that woman who's working for you?
Yeah. So there's mostly women and children in the camps. And what are they doing there? Are they just being held prisoner, or was the intent always to kill them? Were they killing them in waves and bringing, like, if you're killing 6 million people, it's a pretty high rate of death.
So there was lots of different camps. Everyone knows the main camp of Auschwitz.
Dresden was another one, right?
Yeah. You have Treblinka as well. And you have to remember all these numbers, they were going through Europe as well, killing them as well. They were killing Russians. They were killing Poles. They were killing the Hungarian Jews as well. So they were coming from all over Europe. They weren't just from Germany. And they were killing the disabled. Yeah, it was definitely in 40 to 41. It was the T4, which is the gas murders. And they would take gas vans through Europe and Germany. And these were just vans that were gas chambers, that mobile gas vans.
Really?
They would put people in there and kill them that way. So that's essentially one of the ways it started. It was mobile gas chambers, and they would kill small amounts of people in those chambers.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about the gas chambers at the actual camps. Were they almost like showers or something like that? Or was
there... Yes, they would put them into the gas chambers and under the roof that they were showers and they would gas them.
Showers of gas or showers?
It was like Cyclone B. It kind of came from above, and they would just gas them in these chambers.
So that would kill you how quickly? Like, you would be a quick death because you just...
No.
Oh my gosh. So there's such an element of just diabolical, warped, terrible, like with this torture, the just sadistic type of people. Does that come from the top? Is that Hitler saying, or is it Himmler doing this? Like, we're not just going to kill them, but we're going to give them long, painful deaths as well.
Essentially, for them, it was a effective and efficient way of killing. It wasn't necessarily, there were Nazis, and you will find individual Nazis, SS officers. I think there was over 300,000 who have specific acts of like torture, which you can go into later on, but it was essentially not, we want to make their death as long as possible. It was efficient. You could pile hundreds and hundreds of people into these gas chambers and kill them all at once, and then you would obviously
German efficiency, right?
Essentially, that's what it was, which sounds so horrible saying it like it was efficient, well, but that's how they saw it.
That's the way they saw it, right?
So you could pile hundreds of people in there and kill them all at once, and then you would bring more. So one of the interviews we had for our documentary was, from what I remember, this was a few years ago, one of the gentlemen who was in the camps, he was in a line, and he said there was an SS guard walking past him, and he was like, oh, what's the smoke coming from that chimney? And the SS guard replied to him, that's your family.
Oh my gosh.
So you have to remember there would be lines, and they would split into who was going to the gas chambers and then who was going to work.
To work, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, the guy that you mentioned that saw his family burning, how does he end up still alive today?
So a lot of the teenagers, like young boys, they were seen as fit and healthy, and they could go and work. If you were, you know, malnourished, you didn't look like you could do hard labor, because they were working from 5, 6 a.m. in the morning on, again, less than 500 calories. And they would be working in the cold, in the harsh weather, in Poland or in Eastern Europe, on so few calories, doing hard labor. And you would have to be physically fit.
That's terrible. Mm-hmm. So basically they just survived because the war ended and everybody was basically let go, emancipated.
They were liberated in the camps. Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the more mentioned kind of some of the experiments. Where did this start? And what were they doing? Give us kind of a little bit on that. Because you hear, is it Mengele?
Dr. Mengele.
How do you pronounce it?
I pronounce it Mengele.
Mengele, Dr. gotcha. Mengele, yeah. I have no idea.
So he is one of the main ones who everyone knows about who did the experiments at Auschwitz. So in Birkenau, you can see where his kind of office. I don't know what word you want to use to call it. It's actually just a pile of rubble now. And essentially the Nazis had these like social Darwinist health measures that took place. And they would use these experiments, not necessarily for medical research or to propel the field of medicine. Uh-huh. They would use it for the sake of it. So I think in Ravensbrück, for example, they would transplant in the legs one tibia to another tibia. They would
transfer one tibia.
Yeah, to like a tibia. Almost like bone transplants, and they would inject them with the women's legs. I think there's images as well. You can, you know, they took photographs of this where they would inject women's legs with bacteria and then try and treat it again. And a lot of these women were Polish women as well in these camps. And these women would undertake these experiments with no anesthetic. So they would be injected with things and then try and treat it. And a lot of them were, if they couldn't take on any more experiments, they were shot.
Like you said, they injected gangrene?
It was a type of gangrene almost. It was sulfamonide.
Uh-huh.
Sulfamonide. And I think I pronounced that wrong again. They would inject that into their legs as well.
And that would just be complete pain. It's terrible.
I can't even imagine. And again, no anesthetic for these women as well.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, if I'm just actually reading Slayer's Angel of Death, which when you're in high school is kind of the, you know, the opening line of Auschwitz, the meaning of pain, the way I want you to die. But they talk about that, about no anesthesia, pumped with fluid inside your brain. Pressure in your skull begins pushing through your eyes. Is this some of the stuff that they do? Burning flesh strips away. Test of heat burns your skin. Your mind starts to boil. They're testing how much heat you could take, how much cold you could take. that sort of thing as well? Is that they're used to do?
All the time. And they also, in the women's camps, they would... So abortion wasn't allowed in Germany, but then a lot of these women who were prostitutes would come to the camp and they would be pregnant. So they would perform abortions there with no anesthetic. And the abortions, because they didn't have... Ravensbrück at this time didn't have a kind of incinerator or a crematorium, so they would perform these abortions. And in the book, it, you know, says how after these abortions, they would carry the fetuses in a bucket across the camp and put them in the boiler room.
Oh, it's just terrible.
And again, with Ravensbrück, the issue was because Auschwitz was liberated before that, a lot of people came to Ravensbrück, and then because they were losing the war, and you have to remember they were going to be tried for war crimes, they had to get rid of all the evidence.
Right.
So they burned a lot of the files. So everything that we're talking about now, that's probably a very small amount of what we actually know. I can't even imagine what we don't have evidence of. And they would burn the files, and there was a lake by Ravensbrück, and they would throw all the files into the lake as well. So you couldn't see anything. You couldn't have evidence.
You wouldn't know.
No.
Was there some kind of a obsession with twins?
Yeah, so...
Is that Mengele?
Yeah, he would perform experiments on twins because obviously wanted this Aryan master race. I'm dumbing that down a little, but that's essentially what they wanted. And a productive way for them to build up their population and have this master race was to have twins. You know, what's better than one Aryan child? There's two. So they would take twins, perform experiments on them, inject their eyeballs. They tried to change the eye colors of them as well. Some pretty horrific. And experiments went on. And if you didn't survive the experiments, you were shot. So you can imagine that these poor people had experiments performed on them. And if they couldn't be experimented on anymore, they were just shot.
Just shoot them. How did Hitler get to such... level of power, prominence of power? You mentioned the compliance and all that sort of thing. Like, how does that get to the point of no return? You know, and even though it seems like it's ancient history, it was only, you know, not even 80 years ago. Mm-hmm. There's, like we mentioned, there's still people that are alive from those camps. How did it get so out of control? Do you know?
I'm not a historian.
No, I understand. From what you've studied, what you've learned.
So it was the World War One had to happen. Germany was very destitute after the Weimar government came into power, and they were sanctioned massively after the First World War, and they were just economically broken. And unfortunately, that's how it started. And 1933 is when January he came into power, and they didn't even receive a majority vote, so they came into power without a majority vote, and then everything just kind of escalated from there. They managed to get hold of emergency powers. And again, it started from 1933 onwards. And when we're talking about the compliancy, there's always that question of, did people know? Were people aware of what was going on?
You mean around the world or just within the country?
Within the country, gotcha. But also around the world, of what was going on to the... you know, populations that they didn't favour, and were people officiating their regime, essentially. And it's interesting because I think around in the 40s, the Allies flew planes over Germany and dropped leaflets saying, the leaflets were saying something along the lines of, we know what's going on because of the mass extermination. So if the Allies knew what was going on, they dropped leaflets over Germany to say, we know what's going on and we're going to punish you. The planes would fly over and drop leaflets in the population of Germany. So, you know, if the Allies knew what was going on, surely the population knew as well. But of course, there was also people who saved a lot of...
Let's talk about that, yeah.
Yeah, so obviously a lot of people didn't... They didn't necessarily comply, but they also didn't stand up and say something as well. And unfortunately for them at the time, that was probably an easier choice.
Right.
But you have to remember, again, like over 300,000 people worked for Hitler. So that's 300,000 people that were part of his regime. A good example of someone who worked for him, but says they didn't. She denies being a Nazi is Leni Riefenstahl, who did all of his propaganda films like Triumph of the Will. She said later on that she was not a Nazi, but then she made his huge propaganda films. The industry was littered with propaganda because.
So tell us what kind of a propaganda film, because there is one in Inglourious Basterds. It was actually directed by Eli.
Yeah.
But tell me kind of what they would use those for and what they would kind of show in those movies.
Because you have to remember that it's not necessarily what you hear, but what you see as well, like subliminally.
Perception is reality, right?
Yeah. So Hitler loved movies. Himmler loved movies. He loved the movie industry and, you know, a way to get people to take the propaganda was through the medium of film. People can see it, and that's what they did. And Leni Riefenstahl was one of the main directors. Triumph of the Will is probably the most known film, but they also made propaganda films such as, I think it was called The Evil Jew or The Eternal Jew, and it was an anti-Semitic film that portrayed Jews as evil as well. So you have to remember when people went to the cinemas and watched these films, they came out thinking that. Because you have to remember also, you know, when I was a kid growing up, I had no context of history. And when I watched, sure. I watched films and Russians were the bad guys because of the Cold War. These American movies portrayed Russians as the bad guys. So as a kid, I got thinking, oh, Russians are the bad guys. These people,
they were brainwashed.
The population of Germany, they would essentially come out thinking, oh, the Jews are evil.
I had Dee Snider on a few months ago talking about Russia and kind of the organization he was setting up, where he was having celebrities read the real reports of what's going on in the Ukraine that Russia people would get that couldn't be filtered through some of their social media. And because if you don't do that, people just believe what they see and read on here on TV. So people would go to the movie theaters. And would these be long movies, like feature films? Or they'd be
some
like
of them were short movies.
Gotcha.
Some of them a little bit longer. And it was just a way for them to filter across their message as well.
Right. So who are some, I mean, obviously you talk about Schindler's List, and that was about somebody who kind of had this underground railroad to save concentration camp victims. Was there others like that, or do you know the story of Schindler? Kind of explain what exactly he did.
So
let's talk about
that.
When
we were in Poland, we actually visited Schindler's factory. So Schindler, he saved quite a lot of people by putting them to work in his factory, so they weren't.
Well, so he kind of had some kind of carte blanche to use whoever he wanted, and Hitler wouldn't come in there?
So a lot of people think it was Hitler giving every single order, and he was obviously in charge, but he also had other people in charge of his camps, and Himmler was with the main people to design the camps. So it wasn't necessarily just from him. It was him. He was the leader, but there was so many other people underneath him that would organize all of this as well.
So he would have them just work in his factory, and that would give them a safe harbor?
Almost, yeah. I mean, a lot of them, you'll have seen it in the movie. Obviously, it's very, I don't know what the word is, movie-sized movies.
Yeah, Hollywoodized,
you know?
Right.
But essentially, there were people that harbored Jews and took them to safety. A lot of them fled as well. One of my favorite directors of all time is Douglas Sirk. He was married, and his ex-wife was actually a member of the Nazi Party. And he married a Jewish woman, and because his ex-wife was a Nazi, he was forbidden from seeing his son again.
Oh.
And he ended up going through Europe to carry on making films, and then eventually he came to America and worked in Hollywood, and he was a fantastic director. He did a film called All That Heaven Allows, which was one of my favorite movies. But he fled Nazi Germany and, you know, came over here with his Jewish wife because his Jewish wife was being persecuted.
It's interesting because you know, Bruno Sammartino, one of the most famous wrestlers of all time in America, came from Italy, which was being occupied by the Nazi regime. And his mother took him and his brother to hide in the mountains of Italy. Uh-huh. And she would leave to go back into the city to grab food and would be gone for days at a time with Bruno and his little brother, just waiting with other people. She was kind of the breadwinner. So people, like you said, people had to flee. They just had to get out of the way of this war machine to try and survive and hide wherever they could.
Yeah, and unfortunately a lot of them didn't.
Yeah.
A lot of them, again, prostitutes, apoliticals, religious people that didn't fit in with what they wanted were just
done,
sent to these camps.
So was there ever any documentation, like was it possible to escape from a concentration camp? Is there ever any stories of someone who was able to do that?
I don't know of any particular stories of like any particular person, but it has been documented that people did manage to escape.
How could you escape?
I have no idea. Yeah, right? I have no idea. So a lot of them survived just through, I don't know, I guess sheer will.
So was this almost like a walled in type of a camp, like a prison almost?
Barbed wire fencing. So the one in Auschwitz that I went to in Auschwitz-Birkenau, it was all barbed wire fencing. And a lot of them were like very highly guarded as well. You couldn't escape.
Yeah. That's the principal idea. So let's talk about like in the 60s and 70s, you heard a lot of like, I don't know the exact name, maybe it was Mengele or maybe it was Himmler or something. They kind of had escaped and they were living in America or something. You would find out that they were Nazi war criminals. Let's talk about some of that.
Okay, so I actually, this reminds me, so this is one of the documentaries I watched with my dad as a kid, and I only vaguely remember parts of it. There were a lot of rumors, and obviously some of them it has found to be true, that a lot of the Nazis fled to South America. And one of the rumors I remember watching on this documentary is that one of the doctors flew to a town in South America. I don't know where it is, unfortunately, I can't remember. And he carried on, experimented there. And then in this particular town, the population of twins started going up. After he said, again, I don't know if this is true. Like, this was on a documentary I watched a long, long time ago as a kid. But it's always stuck with me that a lot of these Nazis fled to South America because they were going to be tried as war criminals because what they did was abhorrent.
Of course.
And they, you know, they deserve to see justice for what they did. And obviously you had the Nuremberg trials after where some of them were hung and put into prison. But a lot of them did flee to South America as well.
Because there's a famous story by Stephen King called Apt Pupil, short story, where this kid finds out that his old man neighbor is a Nazi war criminal and then starts to basically, you know, torture him to do things that he doesn't want to do, which turns him back into this terrible Nazi killer. Mm-hmm. It takes place in America. And I remember, like I said, there was a few that you'd see, like, you know, He called himself Ernie Schwartz, but he's really like Mengele or somebody like that. You would see these guys would kind of get weeded out and found.
I mean, a few years ago, they were still getting tried and sentenced to prison. And these men are in their 90s, 80s, 90s. And
as they should be.
Yeah, of course, they absolutely should be.
Right.
And, you know, at the Nuremberg trials, they were tried for all of their war crimes there as well. I mean, one that I was actually just reading about the other day was one called, I think it was Dorothea Binns, and she was only 20, 21, and she was one of the main women who, one of the main guards at the Ravensbrück camp. And you have to remember this, like, 21-year-old was essentially indoctrinated. So she was 20 odd years old when she was working at this camp, and you have to remember that all through the 30s, in the, you know, late 1920s, that she was filled with this ideology and which she thought what she was doing was right at the time.
Right.
Because she didn't know any different. So what she experienced in the camps and how she treated people was the complete norm for her. And obviously she was tried after as well.
So I just looked up Mengele, and he did flee to Buenos Aires, where he got a job as a carpenter. And then he moved to the house of a Nazi sympathizer. And then he was finally outed in about 1956, which is crazy. Think about that. That's like 12 years later. He was just living on the lam under a fake ID. And he was found by practicing medicine without a license in Argentina after a teenage girl died from an abortion. And then basically all just came back out again. Like you said, like just reading about how these guys were able to do this and just escape and fleeing through South America. And once again, this is pre-cell phones and everything else that you could do. But it's just amazing to me that those guys fleed. So when Hitler's regime kind of fell apart, they just were able to get out of the country and run away?
A lot of them were, yeah. And a lot of them fled right before the end of the war because they knew the war was ending as well.
Right.
And there are still obviously ones out there who've maybe passed away or who got to live their life and with no consequence for what they did.
How was Hitler finally brought down? Like, what was the final straw?
So obviously it was towards the end of the war. Germany was losing the war and he killed himself.
In the bunker in Hamburg? I think it was in Hamburg because I know, like, when I live there, there's Hitler's bunker is right in the middle, kind of right near the Reeperbahn. Mm-hmm. And it might not be the one where he killed himself in, but it was a big, black, ugly, like, fat spider on, in the middle of the city. It just had a vibe about it. Like, oh my gosh, you just see it and you think, oh, there's evil, evil vibes come from that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't get that when you were at Auschwitz?
It wasn't. You got evil vibes. It was just, I can't explain the way it made you feel. It was, I think because also I was filming as well.
Yeah.
You're kind of like protected from, because you're looking at it through a camera.
Right.
So obviously I was experiencing it and then you kind of feel guarded from the,
yeah,
the horror of it because I was looking at it through the perspective of a film as well.
It's interesting because I know when I went to the pyramids in Mexico, the Aztec pyramids, and you go stand on the altar of sacrifice, which is, I don't know, about 20 flights of steps up, and you're standing there and, like, I'm pretty sure you can see the blood stains in the rocks, at least in my mind's eye, I recall that, but you just feel, like, uneasy, like, you know something happened here, you know? And it's interesting because I think those spirits and those vibes kind of continue on, like I said, like from the bunker, you know.
They should, because it's something that obviously we should never forget, and it's so prevalent to what is going on in the world today. And I've always said that everyone should try and visit Auschwitz-Birkenau if they ever get the chance. They should always read about it, but they should visit there, because I think to see, you read about it in the history books and you can know every single number fact, but being there is
different, right?
It's completely different.
Yeah.
And I actually remember, so one of the strangest things for me when I was there actually was one of the stories I'd heard before I went. And again, I've got a few stories that my dad would tell me, because his history teacher, my dad was born in the 50s. So when he's a huge, huge history buff. So when he was taught history in school, everything was so kind of, I guess, fresh.
Yeah, brand new almost.
Yeah. So one of the stories he told me was when the prisoners would line up for soup
Yeah.
So there was this huge barrel and the top, you had to, if you wanted a good portion of the soup that was filled with meat, you had to be in a certain part of the queue. So if you were at the front, you would kind of just get very, very watery soup. And if you were in the middle, you would just, again, get watery soup. But if you were towards the end of the queue, all the meat would sink. So if you were at the end of the line, you would get the meaty part of the soup. But unfortunately, if you went too far at the end of the line and there was no soup left, you didn't get any.
Oh, wow.
And it was really strange for me because when I went to Auschwitz, there was a soup machine there. And because I knew this, it felt so strange. And there was soup in a vending machine right here that you could just pay for.
Wow.
And I was thinking, I remember that story and I was like, it completely, I can't explain how it made me feel, but it wasn't a good feeling.
Right.
And you think, like, wow, I can pay for soup.
You can have as much soup as you want.
Yeah, and then these,
you know. They had to figure out the place in line to get the best soup.
Yeah.
You mentioned before about the story about the German shepherds and the dogs.
Oh, yeah, I told you that.
Since we're talking about food.
So when I was obviously researching for the documentary, I spoke to my dad, because the way my dad spoke about German history, that's how I got into it. That's how
he was quite knowledgeable about it as well.
Yeah, he is so knowledgeable. And he would always be passing me his books that he had read to pass on to me. And I've still got so many of them now. And one of the stories that stuck with me, so I met up with him for a coffee and I kind of, like, you know, had my phone out when I was recording it. And the story was that, again, I don't have any kind of, like, this is what he told me that his history teacher told him. So I don't know the name of the camp, but there was one night a fight broke out in the Russian bunker. And obviously, everyone knows, you've seen the imagery that the Nazis had German shepherds. So they sent in two dogs to sort the fight out in the bunker. And when the guards return, the Russian prisoners had eaten the dogs.
That fast?
That's what, yeah.
That's crazy, right?
So obviously you have to remember these men in the bunkers, these women in the bunkers are all starving. The Russians, the guards had sent in two German shepherds to break up the fight, and the dogs.
So they were able to overpower the dogs and then eat them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that makes perfect sense to me. You know, like you said, like, you know, we talk about like the plane that goes down in the Andes or the Donner Party.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing to eat.
They ate their fellow passengers. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's again. That's one diminutive story out of Lord knows how many stories. That's one that my dad told me. And again, like I said, like a lot of the evidence was destroyed. Destroyed. And a lot of these testimonies came from people who did survive. So you can't even imagine the horrors of the people who didn't survive. So one of the things I was reading about literally just the other day was I came across this article, and some people who work in Auschwitz, they'd found a photo album made of human skin.
Oh, my gosh.
So one of the camps, I want to double check the name of it.
Get the camp, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So they would ask actually skin people, hopefully after they died, but presumably maybe even while they were alive,
mm-hmm.
and they would make book covers out of them.
Wow. Buchenwald. I think it was Buchenwald is the camp, and that was where... So there was this kind of, I don't want to say myth because you don't know if it's true, that was the human lampshades made out of human skin.
Right.
And they don't know if it was destroyed. And did you say you've heard of that already?
I've heard of that.
Yeah, before. Yeah. So obviously it's a kind
That's
of...
That's a thing, yeah.
Yeah, it's a thing that they made photo albums, wallets, lampshades out of human skin. And one of the things that they did find of evidence of stuff being made of human skin was this photo album. I think from what I remember, someone had found it in their attic and from the Second World War, and they must have handed it in or sent it to people. And when they checked it, it was supposedly made from human skin. And it's one of, I think that was in like 2020 that they found it. So there's stuff still being found now of evidence of their atrocities. And I can't remember the name of the woman. She was actually killed by the SS. Her husband was killed by the SS. And they ran one of these camps. She was sentenced to prison, I think. And I think she killed herself later on. She was one of the people that ran these camps. And obviously I have tattoos, you have tattoos, and you know, some of the prisoners would have tattoos, and they would look at prisoners who had tattoos and they would take the skin of the tattoos and use them for things like wallets, supposedly.
Oh my gosh. So in each prisoner would have a tattoo of like their inmate number?
Yeah, of course, but they also just had tattoos in general.
Oh yeah.
And if, you know, they liked the artwork, they would use them for things like wallets. Apparently, again, these are all things that I've kind of, because of my interest in it, I've read, I've spoken to people, because obviously I went to Poland and I spoke to people, and there's stuff you read again in history books, but then there's people who had family there who haven't had books written about them. They haven't been able to give what their mum told them, their grandma told them, and these stories are kind of passed down.
Well, let me ask you this. You said that you talked to the one guy who's saw his family burning. What else did he tell you anything else? What's the demeanor of somebody who lived through something like that?
Well, even I remember in school, we had a gentleman called Jack who came to our school actually to do a talk. He survived the Holocaust.
Oh, he was a concentration camp
survivor. Yeah, he was in a concentration camp, and he survived. And one of the things that really stuck out for me when he came was I think it was his 8-year-old brother was put in a separate queue and you never saw him again.
Yeah.
And that happened a lot. Families were split up.
Right.
And Himmler in particular, for women, one of the biggest kind of forms of torture, I guess, for them was having their children taken away, being taken away from their families.
Right? And
he punished women differently to how he would punish the men. They would just be separated from their families, from their children. They'd never see their children again. And again, that is another form of torture.
Didn't you mention too earlier that they saw the women just as more of I can't remember the word that you used, but just as basically just a way to make babies?
Yeah, because obviously also they wanted this Aryan race. So they wanted women to have as many children as possible, because that would help them bring up this population that they wanted.
So let's say you came in there and you were, because you mentioned earlier that Hitler wanted the blue-eyed, blonde-haired Aryan race. Mm-hmm. So let's say you came into the concentration camp as a woman and you were blonde-haired and blue-eyed. Would you kind of be used as a incubator?
Well, if you were in the camp, you were probably opposition to them.
Okay.
So they encouraged what they considered healthy German population to...
Oh, I see.
To reproduce.
Gotcha.
The ones in the camps, obviously some of the women were raped and became pregnant that way, and they... Abortion, again, before, was not allowed in Germany at the time.
But they didn't want the babies. So
they didn't want these undesirable babies.
And have the abortions without anesthesia. So a few last things as we start to wind down here. And even if you don't know the answer technically, how did Germany kind of rebound after Hitler was taken out of power? Because the rest of the world was probably just looking at Germany and obviously – Japan as well is just the most horrible place on the planet. I mean, do you know anything about that? Did it take a while for the country to rebound? Did a new guy come in and say Hitler was wrong and we're going to make this right?
Obviously the Second World War led to the Cold War. So that's when you had the kind of divide where the occupation of East Germany and the occupation of West Germany, where Russia occupied one side, America... That's it. That's an entirely...
Oh, wow. Yeah, so that's why Germany split.
Start of the Cold War, yeah.
With the Berlin Wall. And the Cold War was between America and...
Russia.
And Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And why did Russia step in? Because they were just the next one in line?
Russia were also helping liberate the camps at the time as well.
Oh, I see.
So the Russians liberated Auschwitz. And then the Americans were also in the war. And then they were both...
But just to clarify, so the reason why the Berlin Wall came was because there was West Germany and East Germany. Mm-hmm. It was one side still more Hitler supporting, the other side.
So one side was very kind of communist. The other side was the American side, essentially.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Interesting. I didn't know that. I don't know why.
There was so much that came from the Second World War.
So much that came because of this.
Yeah. And also that's why some of the stuff we're still only learning about today from the Second World War didn't get kind of, I guess, known at the time, because so soon after the Second World War, we had the Cold War.
Yeah, one right into another.
Yeah.
I never knew why there was a Berlin Wall. It's interesting. See, you taught me something. Taught me a lot of stuff. I guess last question for you. Could something like that ever happen again in the modern world? I mean, could you ever see... Because you think of Hitler, that was almost kind of an antichrist situation where the most evil guy takes his control and takes his power. And we've seen, elements of that since. We're even kind of going through it now with what Putin's doing with the Ukraine. But, I mean, could that ever happen again?
Happened again. There's been genocides in other countries around the world. So it's something people say we learn from history, but this stuff is still going on in the world, and that's why we should never forget things like the Second World War and the mass extermination of so many populations, because genocide is still going on in the world.
That's a great point, though, and that's why I wanted to do this today, was people need to remember and never forget what exactly we're talking about here. What's the final solution? Is that something that was known for the Nazis?
Yeah, so the final solution was Hitler's final plan to exterminate all of the Jews.
Gotcha, that's what he called it?
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, such a evil person, whole evil mindset, but...
The entire regime was evil. There was so many... I have so many little kind of, stories and little notes that I've read from certain individual officers who ran these camps, because it wasn't... Hitler wasn't running these camps. He had men doing it for him.
Right.
That's what people need to remember as well. There were so many individual evil people that participated.
They kind of took the ball and ran with it in another direction?
Yeah.
Kind of abuse of power?
Yeah, completely, okay. Completely. And that's what people have to remember as well. So many people part of this. They were all throughout Germany. A lot of them worked in the camps. There were women who were guards in the camps as well. And what was interesting was Himmler gave the women dogs for their weapon of choice. So the women went around with dogs because they would run the camps differently. So Himmler felt like women should run the women's camps. There were obviously men in charge of the women. And they would give them dogs to take charge of the camps.
Wow.
Yeah. But then one woman who, her name is gone, she ran the Ravensbrück camp. And she apparently did such a good job there that they sent her to Auschwitz. And it got to the point with her that she was fired from Auschwitz and went back to Ravensbrück because of what she saw in Auschwitz. She didn't... The horrors she saw at Auschwitz were so bad that she couldn't comply with what they were asking of her, and she went back to Ravensbrück because she didn't physically punish the prisoners.
Oh, I see.
She would use other means of punishment. And then you have another women's guard who would physically punish and torture the women as well. So that's what's really interesting, because these evil people, they have levels that they wouldn't go to, but even the levels they would go to are still abhorrent.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there any books that people can read that you've read that you think explain a lot?
Yes. So one of my favorite books that I've read, I think three times now, is called If This Is a Woman, and it's by Sarah Helm. It's about If This Is a Woman, it's by Sarah Helm. It's one of the Ravensbrück camp books. It's probably the main book on it because so little research was done on the women's camps.
Right.
They only started researching the women's camps around the 90s because the women were kind of like a forgotten part of the Holocaust.
Right.
Another book is called The SS Einsatzgruppen, and I can't remember who wrote it. Maybe we can find it and put it in a link below. But it's an orange book that I remember buying when I was 16 or 17. And that goes into the details of the Einsatzgruppen, who were the death squads that went throughout Europe. So you can read and learn about all the horrors that went through Europe and what people had to endure as well there.
You're amazing, Hannah. Great stuff, and thank you. And like you said, never forget this so that it can never happen again. Mm-hmm.